Okay, so in terms of evolution and cell biology, so I wasn't really expecting to, you know, speak for the program, but the idea that Mike and Shelley and, he's Shelley, there is another Shelley, wasn't involved in the in putting this program together. So their idea was to bring together cell biologists who think about how cells function, and evolutionary biologists who think about how life has evolved. And surprisingly, those two communities don't talk to each other very often. Even in my own department, I'm one of the only people who thinks about evolution. Most people think about the structures of molecules within cells and or compartments within cells and how all those things work, but they don't really think about how they came to be. So I think this the Evo Cell workshop has been a fantastic interaction between those two groups of people. So hopefully that addresses the issue of why evolutionary cell biology. I should mention that there are a lot of physicists involved in this, because it turns out that there are structures within cells that behave in ways that theoretical physicists can address that biologists can't. All right, so the title of my talk was Microbes and Cancer-Pathogenic Pesticides, and I think I've already engendered a little bit of discomfort by putting these structures on the wall, because I keep hearing these, I never took organic chemistry kinds of comments. So let me start with just a couple of conventions. If you don't see an atom at a vertex, that means it's a carbon. Okay, nervous laughter. How many people knew that? Okay, so a few of them know it. Okay. Also, chemists have the tendency to not want to write out all the hydrogens in an atom. So actually, this is a CH3, and this is a CH3, and this is a CH2, and this is a CH3. Okay, and so we just get tired of writing hydrogens. So we don't. And so if you see, like I had up here before, a line going to there, it means there's a carbon there, and the hydrogens are implied. Okay? All right. Everybody's still here, nervous laughter. Okay. All right, so these are...
You're doing the right thing.
Oh, good. Okay. These are two of my favorite pesticides. Not particularly like pesticides, but what my lab works on is the evolution of new metabolic pathways in bacteria. And pesticides, these two pesticides are anthropogenic, which means they were made by humans in the 20th century and introduced in fairly large quantities to an environment that had never seen such things before. Okay, and that poses some interesting questions. Like what will happen to those kinds of chemicals? These are only two, of course, of thousands of chemicals that are being introduced in the environment as a result of anthropogenic activities. Other things include munitions, so a lot of the nitroaromatics that go boom from the army are anthropogenic. Textile dyes, all kinds of products that are used for synthesis of pharmaceuticals and in household products. Okay, so we're doing this on a very large scale. And one of the things that I'm interested in is what happens to these chemicals when they end up in the environment. So you can imagine.
How closely related is, say, this atrazine to natural compound?
Not. It's not. But that is a very important parameter. I forgot where I was. Ah, yes, okay. The two extremes of what could happen to chemicals that get dumped in the environment. One is, I suppose the attitude that people had when these things were first being synthesized and dumped in the environment is, don't worry, something will degrade it. It'll be fine. The other extreme might be, well, these are anthropogenic. They don't look like anything that that soil bacteria have ever seen before, so nothing's going to happen. So in fact, the truth is somewhere in between for most of these kinds of molecules. And the reason that I chose to talk about atrazine and pentachlorophenol is that they lie at fairly opposite ends of this spectrum. Okay. So atrazine is the second most widely used pesticide in the United States. I'm giving you figures from the United States, not because I'm U.S.-centric, but because it's a lot easier to come up with the numbers for the U.S. So in the U.S., this is used at a rate second only to glyphosate or Roundup. It is used as an herbicide on particularly corn crops, but also sorghum and sugarcane. And it, what it does is it blocks it blocks broadleaf weeds that would contaminate the crop. So it is used at the rate of 70 million pounds per year in the U.S., which is a lot. Pentachlorophenol was, okay, so I should say atrazine was first introduced in the late 1950s. Pentachlorophenol was first introduced in the 1930s. It is primarily used as a wood preservative, so for things like telephone poles and railway ties, you know, applications where you don't want the wood rotting out and having to be replaced quickly. It is used on a much smaller level. Its use is restricted to those kinds of wood preservation applications because it is highly toxic and it tends to accumulate in the environment and it's difficult for microbes to degrade it. Okay? So,
is that what's in creams, though?
Yes. So atrazine does have a certain lifetime in the environment, but it is not nearly such a bad actor as this. Okay. Pentachlorophenol, by the way, is a priority pollutant on the list of 124 priority pollutants in the U.S. It is a common chemical found at Superfund sites, and it's quite nasty stuff. Okay, so getting back to this question of, you know, what happens when you dump some chemical into the environment that hasn't been seen before, and what might microbes in the soil, and particularly these two chemicals are degraded when they are degraded by bacteria. So I'm just going to talk about soil bacteria. So what happens when soil bacteria are confronted with something new? So what generally happens with this kind of situation is that if it's going to be degraded, what's going to have to happen is that microbes are going to have to come up with enzymes that can convert these odd-looking things into some kind of metabolite that they recognize and know what to do with. Okay. So my lab works a lot on evolution of new enzymes. Does everybody know what an enzyme is? We're good on that? Okay. Enzymes are protein catalysts. Almost every metabolic reaction that occurs in your body or in any kind of life on Earth is catalyzed by an enzyme. Enzymes can catalyze reactions by up to 21 orders of magnitude, which is, if physicists like that, 21 orders of magnitude. That's a pretty remarkable feat, right, to accelerate a reaction by that amount. So I'm going to give you a little cartoon version of an enzyme. Okay. An enzyme is a protein scaffold that surrounds what we call the active site, which is where the chemistry takes place. And the active site has a shape, and lining this cleft or cavity are chemical groups from the amino acids that are in the protein. Okay. Proteins are polymers of amino acids, and the amino acids have side chains that have particular properties. Some of them are negatively charged, some of them are positively charged, some of them are nonpolar, some of them are polar. So this cleft or cavity in the enzyme will have some charges around it. It may have some sort of hydrophobic pieces. But the idea of this active site is that it will be complementary in shape to a molecule that will bind, that's called the substrate. Okay, so the word substrate means different things to different people, but to enzymologists, the substrate is the reactant. Okay, so I will try to use the word reactant, but I may slip and say substrate because I've been doing this for so many years that it's hardwired in my head. Okay, so the substrate will probably have a shape that's complementary to this pocket of the enzyme so that it can bind nicely. Often the substrate will also have, let's say, charges that are complementary to the pocket in the enzyme. Okay, so this is a nice place for the substrate to bind. But also in this active site of the enzyme are catalytic groups. Okay, and that's where the fun starts. So these catalytic groups include acids and bases that can accelerate reactions. It includes metal ions. So metal ions can be used to polarize things and accelerate reactions. Can include organic cofactors. So the amino acids in proteins are proteins are made up of 20 different amino acids, which provide a nice range of characteristics in terms of charge and chemical properties. They can't do everything. And so over half of all enzymes also contain organic cofactors that are sort of specialized for assisting with various types of chemistry. They also, here's a little piece of jargon that I will define. They include things that are called nucleophiles. And what these are groups that have electrons available to go attack something. Okay? And nucleophiles can be very important in chemistry because they can form a transient chemical bond to something, which can then help other things happen. Okay, so that's what active sites look like. Does anybody have any questions on this so far? I haven't lost anybody yet.
I have a question about something earlier on, actually. So you mentioned that these are two pesticides. How much of the pesticides that actually are effective in getting rid of the insects on the plant are put on the plant versus like produced by the plant itself? And does it make a difference for getting it out of the environment?
Yeah, so plants can make their own insecticides. I'd say they are probably dwarfed by the things that we are dumping on our crops, typically. Okay, so I haven't yet connected enzyme active sites to what happens when these chemicals land in the environment. Okay, so here's the deal. The enzymes that have been evolving for millions or billions of years in living organisms as we know it, are very specific for particular kinds of substrates. Okay. But they are not perfectly specific. So enzymes have secondary activities that are just purely accidents of having an active site that's loaded up with reactive kinds of things. And we call these promiscuous activities. All right. This is another word that has different meanings to different people. We call them promiscuous activities because they're accidental, they're secondary, they're not physiologically relevant to the organism. They just come about because biology is never perfect. Okay, so this active site may be nicely shaped for this particular substrate, but we might not mind if the substrate has that shape. Or it might not mind if the substrate has that shape. So these active sites are not perfectly specific. Okay, and that is why there is hope for degrading something that's brand new.
Okay, are the promiscuous ones, I mean, would it be catalyzing the same reaction like breaking a carbon nitrogen bond or something, but just in a different molecule, or is it something quite different?
That is a very beautiful question. And okay, the reason is yes. Okay. So in some cases, promiscuous activities are due to what's called substrate ambiguity. This is a perfectly timed question. Okay, so substrate ambiguity is kind of like what I just drew, where something that resembles a substrate gets into that active site and the same type of chemistry happens. Okay, that's very common. But it's not the only thing that can happen. So there's a second type that's called catalytic promiscuity. Okay, and this is when a molecule wanders into that active site in proximity to catalytic groups that are here, here, and here, but some other kind of chemistry happens. So that can happen too. So you can end up with promiscuous reactions that look very different from the normal reaction. Those are actually the most fun. Okay, but both kinds of things happen. Okay. All right, so these promiscuous enzyme reactions are going to be what allows microbes to start degrading these anthropogenic pesticides. And they also provide the sort of the evolutionary starting material for new metabolic pathways. So these promiscuous activities that I've been talking about are generally very inefficient, although not always, but usually pretty inefficient. They never accelerate things by 21 orders of magnitude, but they might accelerate things by 6 orders of magnitude. Okay, so if you're talking about the introduction of a new chemical into the environment and the use of an enzyme that normally does something else to now attack something like this, 6 orders of magnitude rate acceleration is nothing to sneeze at. Okay? So these promiscuous activities provide the evolutionary starting point for new enzymes and potentially new metabolic pathways if you can patch together enzymes that can do a sequence of steps. Okay, now, is everybody okay with that idea? Okay, so we have promiscuous enzymes running around doing things. And so I mentioned that what needs to happen is that these unusual looking things need to be degraded somehow into molecules that cells recognize and know what to do with. Okay, so you know this may require complete degradation may require many chemical steps. So for atrazine and pentachlorophenol, the situation is that maybe the first 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 steps may be new, but then they will eventually tie into something that the cell knows already. And then the rest of it, these are all ancestral enzymes, and once you get to here, everything can go. Okay. So the tricky part is this stuff up here. Okay, so it turns out both atrazine and pentachlorophenol are degraded by these kinds of pathways, where bacteria have recruited promiscuous enzymes that normally do other things, and they've patched them together into some kind of pathway that will take this anthropogenic thing into a non-metabolite. So that's the general idea. Yep.
Can I back up and ask, so the grassy crops that you're spraying this on, do they even take these chemicals up? Do they sequester them or something? Or?
So it turns out that corn, so the crops this is used on, have a detoxification mechanism. So, and the broadleaf weeds that are the problem don't. So it turns out to selectively kill the weeds.
So is that natural to the corn, or has it been engineered to have that capability?
No, that's natural to the corn. Although there is, you probably are aware that there are efforts to, it's already been made, crop plants that are resistant to glyphosate, which is a pesticide, so that you can use more glyphosate. And then you can buy more glyphosate from the producer. And then you can buy the seeds for the... and I don't know enough about that whole argument to say much more than that. Worth?
So what effect do they have on bacteria?
So I'm about to get to that. Yeah, you guys are setting both my questions very nicely.
How do you measure this acceleration rate?
That sounds like a physicist. So that's a difficult question because it depends on where you go, what kinds of microbes are there, what concentrations there are. I can only give a very qualitative answer about that, and that this is much more resistant to biodegradation than this is. And so what I want to do next is tell you what some of the important factors are.
The question might have been even simpler. You said that some enzymes accelerate things by 21 orders of magnitude.
Oh, is that the?
Yeah, that's the question.
Yeah.
So how do you measure that?
How do you measure that? Oh, okay. That actually turns out to be surprisingly difficult because a lot of the reactions that go on in living cells are extremely slow without a catalyst. So people have measured the rates of non-enzymatic reactions, sometimes when they go fast enough to be convenient to measure. There's one extremely heroic man named Dick Wolfenden at Chapel Hill, who has gone even further, and he's the one who's measured 21 orders of magnitude. And it amounts to sealing things up in tubes and heating them pretty hot, and measuring the rate, and then trying to extrapolate down to room temperature.
Both of these pesticides have one group that is off of the symmetry. So the atrazine has the CH3 group that is missing on the other side,
right?
And the other one has the OH group, where everywhere else it's is that important? Could you symmetrize it and still get the same?
No. So let me tell you a little bit more about how these things are degraded, and that might help answer that question. Okay. So one. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, one more quick question about this process that you schematically put up there, the A to B to C.
Do you only worry about getting to D, or do you worry that like those processes in A to B and to C don't do anything else that you don't want?
That you don't
create something else that you...
That is a very excellent question because in pentachlorophenol, if pentachlorophenol is A, B is actually more toxic than pentachlorophenol itself. So there is that possibility with catching together promiscuous enzymes is that you might make something that's really bad. In which case, the cell just dies, and that's the end of that story. Okay. All right, so what I want to give you a feeling for is what are the kinds of factors that make this more easily degraded, more successfully degraded than this?
Another more just basic question. I mean, on both of these, is it gaining energy, or is the left one mainly gaining nitrogen?
That's reason number
two.
That's reason number two that I'm going to get to. Okay. Let me tell you reason number one first. Okay. Reason number one, for the reason why these two are different in their degradability, is that this is extremely toxic. It's toxic to pretty much everything. Okay. Atrazine interferes with photosynthesis, okay, which is bad for plants. But it is generally not really acutely toxic to humans. It's not toxic to bacteria, who are the ones that we're talking about doing the degradation. Okay? And of course, chlorophenol, on the other hand, is highly toxic. You want to know why it's so toxic? Okay. So, all forms of life on Earth have to get energy from somewhere. Okay, bacteria get their, non-photosynthetic bacteria get their energy from redox reactions. So they oxidize compounds that are available in the environment, and they may be organic compounds or they may be inorganic compounds. Various bacteria use different different things. Those are thermodynamically downhill reactions. Okay, so they produce energy. Microbes and also the mitochondria in your cells that are related to microbes capture that chemical energy in the form of an electrochemical gradient across a membrane. Okay. So they have a bilayer membrane that is, I'm not going to draw very much in this, but made up of lipids that have long hydrocarbon tails that want to get away from water, and polar head groups that are fine with water, and so they form these lipid bilayers. And the process by which molecules are oxidized leads to a proton gradient across cells. So this is a physical way of storing that gradient, or sorry, physical way of storing that energy. This, the energy in this electrochemical gradient is then used to drive various kinds of processes that are important to the cell, the most important of which is making ATP. Okay. Have the physicists heard of ATP? Okay. All right, so in ATP, energy is stored in a chemical form, and in the form of high energy bonds, and hydrolysis of those high energy bonds can be used to drive thermodynamically unfavorable reactions, okay? All right, so the reason pentachlorophenol is so toxic has to do with the fact that that OH group up there can dissociate. And you can pull the proton off to form this anionic form. And it's in equilibrium with the protonated form. And this negative charge that I've shown up here is not actually completely localized on the oxygen. Okay, it can be delocalized through this aromatic ring, which means that the amount of negative charge on any particular atom in this molecule is not particularly high. Okay, now going back over here to this, pentachlorophenol, when it's protonated, is quite hydrophobic. Loves to hang out in membranes. So it can cross the membrane. Okay, so if it's on the outside, it can go to the inside, can shuttle back and forth. Okay. But so can this deprotonated form. Okay, the deprotonated form can shuttle back and forth. Okay, so now here's what happens. You can probably see it coming. The deprotonated form out here picks up a proton, happily diffuses across, dumps it off, diffuses back, picks up another one. Okay? So the reason pentachlorophenol is so toxic is that it destroys this electrochemical gradient, which is then used to make ATP, drive transport processes, sometimes drive motion. Okay. That tends to be very bad. So it's also bad for you because, as I said, the mitochondria in your cells are like bacteria. They make these kinds of electrochemical gradients. Okay, so reason number one that it's hard for pentachlorophenol to get degraded in the environment is that it tends to kill things, and dead things don't degrade. Okay, that's a pretty good reason. That's also why, for example, we're not putting 70 million pounds of this stuff a year on corn crops. Okay.
So presumably the rate for that then is much faster than the normal way of sort of decharging this lipid battery, for lack of a better way of saying.
Yeah, it's pretty efficient at dissipating that proton gradient. Okay, let's see. Daniel, you were asking, second reason. So what does the bacterium get out of degrading these compounds? Okay, well, that is a very important aspect of this too, because pentachlorophenol is not a very good, so these types of molecules could serve as sources of carbon, sources of energy by oxidation to make these proton gradients, and in the case of atrazine, sources of nitrogen. So pentachlorophenol, it turns out, is actually not a very good source of carbon and energy because the carbon is actually fairly oxidized already. Okay, so carbon in its most reduced form in methane has an oxidation state of -4. In its most oxidized state, it has an oxidation of +4. All the carbons in pentachlorophenol have an oxidation state of +1. Okay, so they're already pretty oxidized. So that means this is not going to be a very good source of carbon and energy. Okay. Atrazine, on the other hand, has these side groups where the carbons are much more reduced. So that's good if you're going to make a living off of redox reactions. The more reduced something is, the more energy can be captured. But more importantly than that, this molecule has 5 nitrogens in it. And nitrogen is often a limiting reagent for growth in natural environments. Nitrogen and phosphorus are often the things that are in short supply. Okay. So atrazine, so this is kind of like the difference between eating a chocolate truffle and a Brussels sprout, at least in terms of enjoyment. For me, maybe you like Brussels sprouts better than I do, but so this is a very yummy molecule for microbes because they can actually 5 atoms of nitrogen. Okay. Whereas this is much more difficult to get at the resources, and the resources are more minimal to begin with. Okay? All right?
It's a hassle and it kills you.
What?
It's a hassle and it kills
you. A hassle and it kills you, yeah. Okay, so let's see. What other reasons might there be for the differences? Well, a third reason would certainly be just the extent of use. So I told you 70 million pounds a year of atrazine being spread over vast numbers of square miles. So that's a lot of exposure, right? Pentachlorophenol, I couldn't find a number for the actual usage per year, but I can tell you more trivia that I looked up on the internet before this talk. 11 million pounds were produced between the 1930s and 2002. So, okay, much less pentachlorophenol being deposited out there in the environment. So that probably has something to do with it too. There's another very important reason for the difference in the degradative potentials of these things, and that is that partial degradation of atrazine can be beneficial. Whereas to get anything out of pentachlorophenol, you have to get it clear down that pathway. Okay. So the way that atrazine is degraded is that first this chlorine atom is replaced with a hydroxyl group that comes from water. Hydroxyl means OH. Second, either this substituent or this substituent is taken off and replaced with another hydroxyl group. And it can, and then the other one. Okay. So first the chlorine is replaced by a hydroxyl group, and then one of these things is knocked off, and then another one is knocked off. Okay. Knocking off chloride doesn't do anything for anybody, okay? Chloride is not an important nutrient for bacteria. But as soon as you take these groups off, that frees up some nitrogen and some reduced carbon, okay? So the second and third steps in degradation of atrazine are already providing microbes with some benefit, okay? Whereas pentachlorophenol, let's see, I didn't count, but it may be like on the order of 12 or 15 steps before you actually start to get any benefit out of degrading that stuff, okay? All right, so the partial degradation is possible for atrazine, and then we had the question about, well, what, you know, how about partial degradation of pentachlorophenol? And I told you that, so it's not only that you can't get benefit out of partially degrading pentachlorophenol, it can actually be a very bad idea. So the first intermediate that is formed in the pathway for degradation of pentachlorophenol looks like this. Its name is tetrachlorobenzoquinone, which doesn't really matter. What matters is that this is strongly electrophilic. What that means is that these carbons in the ring have partial positive character, and that's because chlorine atoms are electron withdrawing, so they're pulling charge away from those carbons, and this conjugated, it's called an enone system, these two double bonds are also pulling electron density away. Okay, so what that means is that these are very electron deficient. Remember I told you about nucleophiles, which have electrons that are available and are ready to attack something? Okay, this thing is primed for attack by nucleophiles. Turns out some very important groups in amino acids and metabolites in your body are thiols, okay, that's SH, which are in equilibrium with the deprotonated form. This deprotonated form of the sulfide reacts with this like a shot, like in milliseconds. Okay, so this is extremely toxic stuff, far more toxic than pentachlorophenol itself. Yeah.
I have a question. How do you know the degradation pathway? Is this from studying a particular bacteria?
Yeah, this is actually a bacterium that I've been studying for about 23 years. Okay. So I know it pretty well. Okay, so partial degradation in this case is a really bad idea. Which is actually one reason I've wondered about. So pentachlorophenol is very toxic. I was telling you about promiscuous enzymes. A lot of soil bacteria actually have promiscuous enzymes that might be able to do this, which would then just kill them off all the faster. So it turns out that in microbes, the bacterium that we're studying anyway, there is another enzyme that converts this highly toxic stuff to something that is less toxic. And these two enzymes, actually, this stuff never gets out of the active site of the first enzyme. So, you know, it's tucked down in there in the pocket. And then the second enzyme throws electrons at it, which
is
actually
something that evolved.
Well, so I'm sure that it did evolve. Yes. So, no, I don't think it evolved in the presence of PCP. I think it evolved in the presence of some kind of naturally occurring chlorinated aromatic compound. So there are, in fact, naturally occurring chlorinated aromatic compounds. This one is the sex pheromone of the female Lone Star tick.
Obviously.
So there are chlorinated aromatic natural products. The key to this is that most chlorinated aromatic natural products don't have so many chlorines. Okay, and usually these kinds of, the first steps in these pathways occur at a position where there's a hydrogen instead of a chlorine. And if there's a hydrogen instead of a chlorine, you go directly to this and you bypass this. So I think that, so it turns out that these two enzymes obviously work together very well. The genes and the genome are right next to each other. So I think that this is some kind of ancient module that evolved in response to a chlorinated natural product. And it's the module that's been recruited to do this first step. Okay.
Have you ever thought, why do most enzymes just make single changes at a time? I mean, other than make biochemistry books complicated.
Well, actually, if you break it down, most enzymes do more than one step. In reality, there are very few that just do one thing. They're very talented.
You don't have an enzyme that can jump from point A to C here. You're doing it with
two enzymes. No, but then, you know, each of these reactions may involve multiple steps. So it's, but that's an interesting question.
So that form is not toxic?
What, this one?
Yeah.
This guy? Well, I think it's fine for ticks. it wouldn't be as toxic to us because if you this doesn't deprotonate as easily as pentachlorophenol. Okay, so this is getting close to one. I want to tell you one of the very most important reasons why atrazine is more degradable. Okay, and that is that the genes for degradation of atrazine are found on plasmids. And the genes for degradation of pentachlorophenol are found in the genome. Okay, so plasmids?
Remind us.
Okay, so bacteria have chromosomes. This is a bacterium, and it's got a chromosome. Most bacteria have circular chromosomes, but a few have linear chromosomes. Most bacteria have one chromosome, but some bacteria have more. But bacteria often carry around what are called plasmids, which are extra chromosomal genetic elements, their DNA. They're much smaller usually than the genome. And they encode genes. And what's important about these is that they are relatively easily transferred between bacteria. Okay? So the atrazine degradation genes are found in the plasmid, and this plasmid has spread among bacteria. So there are many, many different types of bacteria that now have acquired the genes for atrazine degradation. And here's an absolutely freaky number. If you sequence the atrazine degradation genes that you find in the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere, they're 98% identical. Okay, now what that says is these have not been evolving for a long time. They certainly didn't evolve from different directions.
Wait, 2% is pretty far apart in terms of 100 years.
It's pretty, when you compare it to
any
other kind of gene.
But if you compare it with how much evolution you'd get in only 100 years, that's pretty far.
Not in bacteria. Okay, and not in the wide range of bacteria that you see. So the idea is that these soil bacteria containing atrazine degradation genes have been carried on the feet of migratory birds as they fly up and down. And then those genes have been then it's very close. It is. It is too close to have to be okay. If these genes had been evolving and independently and had been recruited to do this, they would be more like they could be 30% to 50% identical if they had been evolving in these bacteria for long periods of time and then had been independently recruited to do this.
But if they've only been evolving since atrazine was introduced,
right?
Then they're extremely unlikely to have diverged by 2%.
Some of them are actually identical. It's more than 98% in all of the isolates that have been sequenced all over the world.
But that gets to the question of evolution, which you mentioned at the beginning. How much evolution has happened to develop the atrazine degraders since it was introduced, and how much of it was serendipitously already there?
Okay. So. Okay. So here's the story about atrazine. On this plasmid. So this is a bigger version of the plasmid. It takes 6 steps to break down atrazine. The last 3 enzymes are close to each other on the plasmid and seem to be a unit, and those are probably the ancestral ones. The first 3 enzymes are scattered around the plasmid. They are surrounded by things called insertion sequences, which help genes move in and out of DNA. And so what seems to have happened is sometime in the 90s, these things successfully got stuck onto a single plasmid. So remember I said that partial degradation would work, okay? And what that means is that atrazine can be degraded by consortia of bacteria. So lots of different bacteria working in common. Okay, so, you know, one microbe might have this enzyme, and one microbe might have this enzyme, one microbe might have this enzyme. And so you get these consortia that can degrade bacteria. But if these genes are on plasmids and they're moving around among bacteria and recombining in new ways, eventually if you keep dumping atrazine into the environment, the horizontal gene transfer that comes from the exchange of these plasmids among bacteria is going to give these genes a chance to sort of hop on. And it appears that this happened sometime in the 90s. So atrazine was introduced in the late 1950s, and people started in the 70s and the 80s, actually, trying to isolate bacteria that could degrade atrazine. And they could only get, you know, partial degradation or consortia or something like that. And then in the 90s, all of a sudden, bacteria started popping up that had this plasmid that had all of the 6 genes. And so what seems to have happened is that an ancestral plasmid that had these guys gradually accumulated the genes for the first 3 steps.
Started popping up everywhere in the world?
Pretty quickly. Yeah, so it started in the 1990s, and very quickly people were isolating bacteria from all over the world that could degrade atrazine, and they were using the same genes.
So that could be, one, because of birds.
Birds, yes.
Or, two, because it's a natural path.
But it wasn't being seen before the 90s, and people were looking really hard.
That might depend on... Presumably could have been some very rare bacteria which then comes up. Population. That goes back to the question of how identical they are.
Yeah,
all of these ones are
so
identical.
Some of them are 100%, 99%, you know, very, 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 very close in terms of the types of bacteria they're found in and the divergence of genes in those kinds of bacteria, which, as I said, could be, you know, 30% identical, and these are 90%.
So there's no correlation between the amount of this present and the amount of atrazine being used?
You mean in terms of the level of degradation in a specific place?
No, I think, some of these microbes will be in fields that aren't treated with atrazine.
Maybe many more.
Some will be in fields that are treated with atrazine.
Yeah,
has
so...
Has this new plasmid appeared principally in the atrazine treated fields?
Yeah. So if you go to sites that have never seen an atrazine or never seen a pentachlorophenol, you do not find degradation. Yeah, so this is all a result of providing this new molecule, which then provides a selective pressure for microbes to
acquire and eat the stuff.
Yeah. So maybe that's another answer to your question, Daniel, is you don't find these genes just out in the wild. Presumably they came from somewhere. And so these genes, I think, were ancestral. These are the ones that probably were recruited because they had a promiscuous activity to do these things.
I don't know.
Quantitatively, there's a lot of these things you could try to distinguish quantitatively. Yeah, we should talk about it in detail.
We'd love to.
Yeah.
So, you know, we know the, so enzymes belong to what are called superfamilies that we can trace based on their sequence identity to other proteins. And so we know for these three enzymes, we know what superfamily they belong to, what kinds of chemistry were done by, are done by related proteins. So presumably these were doing some kind of reaction that was, you know, definitely not these things, but possibly something relatively similar on a natural product. And when they became useful and they started getting passed around rampantly, by horizontal gene transfer, they got collected on this plasmid. Okay, so I...
So you're saying things like recruited, which is kind of anthropomorphic.
And I think what you just said, collected, that there's a picture that somehow there was a plasmid that had the three and it interacted with another plasmid and picked up the three, and then all of a sudden you had a more successful organism. But what about the other idea from over there, that there was a rare plasmid that already had all six that you need, and that...
I think that in theory you wouldn't be able to differentiate between those, except that we do know that there are, like in these consortia, there will be some bacteria that will have, you know, this, and others that will have this gene. So... You know, I guess we don't necessarily know.
The sequence of those three.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's still work no matter what the sequence is, but the...
Oh, right, yeah.
The history.
So the idea that these got... So remember I mentioned these insertion sequences that are around these genes? So if you have a gene and it has these are sites that promote recombination. So... If this bacterium, let's say this is the bacterium with the ancestral module. So bacteria take up DNA from other organisms in their environment by various processes. But let's say this bacterium takes up a piece of DNA that has one of those genes in it. And if it's flanked by these insertion sequences, that can promote its recombination with this plasmid, and then you can get that gene on the plasmid, and if that makes that bacterium more successful.
Right. I was just saying the sequence of those three insertions, A, B, C,
yes,
would work just as well, presumably, I would think, if it's A, C, B.
Right, it doesn't necessarily. You don't have to have all three coming at once, and actually, the fact that they're in different places on the plasmid does suggest
spread
that they
from one,
yeah,
and the border would be common, whereas if it was more random,
recombine.
Yeah, so actually this...
Well, except the insertion sequences can recombine within the molecule as well, so they can rearrange within the molecule.
It all depends on what are limiting factors and how things play on the world and mutation, and so on. Some of which numbers, except for the migration rates and some of the mixing, we know, and so...
Right, and how many bacteria are...
You know, figuring out the quantitative scenarios that are plausible would be very interesting, I think. Because there are not that many cases where there's a complex, where there's a very complex chain.
Yeah, and that's what's so striking about atrazine, and one of the reasons that I picked it is because, okay, this stuff is really, really hard to degrade, and this stuff, the genetic information seems to have spread around the world amazingly fast. So they're really opposite extremes. Forrest?
So given that it's so recent, is it conceivable that this ancestral plasmid, let's say with just three genes, is still hanging out somewhere? So when this is sequenced, one selects for a degrading strain?
So those
if
were
one,
two questions.
If one doesn't choose for the great degraders,
might
find some partial things.
Okay. Yeah, so my guess is that the ancestral plasmid without these things is certainly out there, probably in soil that hasn't seen atrazine. Pretty much everything that we know about these degradation of both of these has come from strains that have been isolated from contaminated soil.
Hmm.
And those are bacteria that we can actually grow in the lab. We can get their DNA. We can do, all kinds of stuff with them. That's certainly not the whole story, because we know that we can only culture less than 1% of what's out there. So there may be a lot of interesting degradation happening in strains that we can't, pull out and culture in the lab. So our information is skewed toward things that are in cultural strains. Now, with the capacity of high-throughput sequencing to do really, deep sequencing of what's out there in contaminated soils, there's now it's called metagenomics. So you can basically go out and sequence everything that's out there, whether it's culturable or not. That brings up some other problems about how do you know who's doing what. But I think, in the last maybe 5 years, we've started to really have the capacity to go out and sequence like crazy. And that may provide some pretty interesting insights into, how often do you see these genes in association with these genes in non-contaminated soils versus contaminated soils.
Can I ask, could this plasmid then be passed on to the weed plants? I mean, then they become resistant to that.
So plants do not generally take up the plasmids that are in bacteria. People are worried about atrazine resistance cropping up, but it happens in plants so very, very much more slowly than it happens in bacteria. Because bacterial populations are immense, and their generation times are short compared to plants. So pesticide resistance in plants is starting to show up, but it doesn't pop up nearly as fast as you see these things in bacteria.
What's the chance that this came out of somebody's lab?
This came out of somebody's lab.
Are we making such an impact that in 20 years, in the 90s, I mean, it's not coincidence, the 90s?
Just knowing the history of how this happened. I mean, these were people who were isolating strains from contaminated soil and that were able to degrade one or the other of these things, and then they were going after the genetic basis of that degradation that was already there.
But for example, suppose these other two enzymes you mentioned, somebody puts it on a plasmid today,
uh-huh.
In 5 years it's going to be all over the world. But if that thing is still widely used.
So if it conferred a a selective benefit to the organism. So in terms of these two reactions, by here, this is still not helping the organism any at all. There's still another 12 steps that have to happen before this is good. So, and those two genes that little module I was talking about appear to be pretty rare. So I've actually combed through all of the genetic information that's in the database looking for those two genes in proximity. And I found like two or three examples among all the things that have been sequenced. So those seem to be pretty rare, which I think is a big part of why phenylporphenol was so hard to degrade. Any other questions?
Thank you. Take one question.
So 20 years, you're saying this happened worldwide in 20 years?
Yeah.
Is that plausible?
Oh, well, yeah, okay, actually, so in terms of plausibility, think about antibiotic resistance, okay? In a way, this is not that different from antibiotic resistance, and what we know about the history of the introduction of antibiotics into the clinic is that within 2 to maybe 6 or 8 years, we start to see clinically significant antibiotic resistance.
We don't understand what sets that time to either, because in the lab, you see them one day.
Yes, that's true.
And
a lot
of
times
that... don't know why it's so slow.
Yeah.
And the spatial credit...
It's a different question. So, everything you're presenting is understanding of these after they've been out in the field doing their business. Mm-hmm. How much of that understanding is now going into modifications of what you actually use?
In terms of pesticides, maybe not so much, but in terms of antibiotics, a lot.
I understand. Right?
Yeah.
With pesticides, you're saying that's not, is it because the understanding is just developing?
Well,
or?
So with pesticides, you know, what people are trying to do is kill pests. And what I'm talking about is degradation in the soil by microbes,
right,
which is actually something that people want. So are you asking, are people trying to design pesticides that are more easily degradable?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know enough about the agrochemical industry to answer that question. I know that we have learned some tough lessons, like the pentachlorophenol, DDT, things like that. We've learned some tough lessons about what not to put in the environment.
That's just a slight variation. So is it true then, if I'm a manufacturer and I want to make some pesticide, I have no responsibility to make sure that it will be degraded in some kind of reasonable amount of time? Do I get to say some bacteria will figure this out at some point?
If it gets great every year, then the farmer has to buy more. So.
No, I know, but if it doesn't get
well,
great,
so
then
I believe
it builds
there
up
is
sort of
some oversight by the USDA. And the EPA requires some kind of registration of pesticides and examination of properties. So, yeah, we seem to be a little more cognizant of some of the issues that I've talked about. So remember, pentachlorophenol was introduced in the 30s, and this in the 50s, and those were definitely the days of better living through chemistry, right? And people just weren't thinking about the downstream effects.
Yeah, do we know exactly what happens in humans when you eat atrazine or PCP?
So,
it's there.
So, yeah.
Thanks for waiting for after lunch to ask.
So, atrazine is not acutely toxic. There is some concern over it being a potential endocrine disruptor. So, there are, but this is one of those huge debates that's going on, particularly between scientists and the company that makes it over whether it's an endocrine disruptor. So it may be responsible for, you know, feminization of rural animals. And so people worry about whether it could be an endocrine disruptor in humans. Pentachlorophenol actually is toxic. Okay, if you get too much of it, you will die. Otherwise, what you get is sort of this skin, like horrible skin acne condition, which I presume goes away.
Actually, I have just a follow-up question. Do we know how long, I mean, the studies that have been done, how long did they monitor? So we know that there is a problem, you know, within a year, or we don't, you know, 10 years, 20 years. It might be that the stuff, you know, has...
So you're talking about how long it lasts in the environment?
No, in
humans?
Yeah. So if systematically for, let's say, 20 years, one is a little bit at a time. I mean, there are no studies whatsoever about the long-term...
I don't know. I know there is the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences that studies that sort of thing, but that's out of my field, so I can't answer that.
Thank you, Sean.